Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC. Looking back at all of Wednesday's Champions League action, all nine games we're going to work through here. My name is Jack Collins, and I will be your host today. And joining me across the water, all the way from San Diego, is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
I'm very happy, mate. Yeah, I'm very happy. I've just watched a couple of nice games side by side, so that's been a nice experience. One of them was a bit of a rout. The other one was very close and is probably potentially going to have some quite big consequences, I would imagine.
Absolutely. I mean, look, Dean, I've got to say I'm a little bit disappointed. When I saw that the first two games, watching the early kickoffs, and they gave us 11 goals between them, I was like, we could be on for a cracker here. We could be on for one of the all-time great nights. And instead, ended up as just 29. So almost half the goals scored in those two early kickoffs. But still some interesting storylines. And look, you referenced it there. I think it's the only place where we could begin is at the Santiago Bernabeu, where Real Madrid lost 2-1 to Manchester City. Now, it's not the end of the world to lose to a City side who are on a rampant run of form. But equally, there were posturing, shall we say, that a negative result here could cost Xabi Alonso his job at Real Madrid. Now, whether you think that's good, bad, indifferent, whether you think that's fair, unfair, you have to remember that Real Madrid runs on a different kind of world pace and world view to the rest of football. And, you know, if there's any sort of divides between the dressing room and the management, it tends to be the manager that goes. This didn't feel like a performance to me that the players had given up on their manager, Dean, but equally, you can never be sure at Real Madrid because funny things happen a lot.
Yeah, I don't think it was terrible, but it's a results market at Real Madrid. And, you know, for a couple of periods in the second half, you just had loud whistles throughout the stadium. And that's the fans giving Alonso a message that something's got to change. So I have some sympathy for Alonso in this particular situation tonight because they've been beaten 2-1. And I thought Man City played very well. I don't think Real Madrid were that bad. And when you take into account the fact that they've got so many players missing at the moment, right? Alaba, Trent, Camavinga, Carvajal, Militao, Housen, Mendy, plus Mbappe doesn't come on in the game. So I can only assume that he's too injured to play. That's a lot of absences. And so you're up against it, first off. You've lost at the weekend. There's a lot of pressure coming into the game. So you're struggling in that sense. And then they did put their foot down in the last 20 minutes. Brahim Diaz ended up coming on. Endrick came on about 10 minutes later. And there was an emphasis on getting that goal. And they could have got it. The difference was, you know when like the Bernabeu gets to that moment and you're like, well, Madrid always score. It didn't really feel like they were going to score. Like they were definitely like looking more likely because they had the ball up that end of the pitch more. But they were kind of just lacking that magic. It's not that they were, as I say, they weren't bad. They just were missing something. And they have been missing something. I think part of this team is against Alonso. I don't think they all are. Ultimately, by the way, obviously, when you go in search of goals like that, you do leave yourselves open, and City themselves could have scored a third. And actually, what was quite interesting about the game was for long periods, it was a very open game. But if you rewind to how it all started, it was looking pretty good. Real Madrid were playing quite well. Rodrigo scores a really good goal to put them in front. They got the ball into a good position. Bellingham progresses it, finds Rodrigo in a lovely position. He advances. O'Reilly's probably too far off him. Can't get across. And Rodrigo steers a brilliant goal into the far corner. So you're like, okay, that's that's a promising start from Xavi Alonso and Real Madrid. It's looking okay. But City very quickly looked to get themselves back into it. And yeah, it obviously doesn't take very long for Nico O'Reilly to equalise. It's a corner, it comes down, keeper saves it, and Nico O'Reilly's there to prod in the rebound. He had a fantastic night, Nico O'Reilly. It'll probably be talked about because he scored a goal. It's his first Champions League goal. There was so, so much to celebrate for him in this game. Like, there was so much to take in. Not only was he have that hard early moment against Rodrigo, he also had moments where he's up against Valverde in really tough moments. He was throwing his body on the line at times. He scores a goal. Like, this is a player. Like, the improvements and, like, the way that this guy's progressed across the season so far is astonishing, to the extent that I think he should go to the World Cup with England. That's a story for another day. But, like, that's how good I think Nico O'Reilly has become, and that Man City have turned him into one of the best left-backs in the Champions League. Anyway, just before half-time, City get a penalty. Rudiger's not happy about it, but he pulls Haaland to the ground.
This is kind of vintage Antonio Rudiger in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
It's weird watching it because you can see what he's trying to do. What he's trying to do is show Haaland that he's still stronger than him. And you'll remember some of their good clashes down the years where, you know, there've been big celebrations from both in these moments. And ultimately, you know, obviously Rudiger's been in and out with injuries, et cetera, et cetera, and really slowly making his way back. He's thrown in here at the deep end. And the truth is, he's probably not quite as strong as Erling Haaland now, whereas he used to probably be stronger than him. And so he tries to sort of hold him off, and Haaland gets round him and gets to it. And the only thing he can do is really drag him to the ground. Is it a little bit soft? Yeah. Is it a penalty? Also, yeah. Like, yeah. There's Haaland's going to get to the ball, I think. And he's denied getting to the ball by Rudiger sort of just wrapping himself around him. So he can look at that in disbelief all you like. But in many ways, it's kind of vintage him. And also probably just an indication of where he is at this point in his career after coming back from a long-term injury. That's no criticism. It's just, you know, you're not as sharp or as quick or as strong the moment you get back from those injuries. And Haaland's taken full advantage to not only win the penalty, but then score it as well.
Yeah, Jamie Carragher said afterwards, I don't watch Real Madrid every week, but Rudiger does that every 3 weeks. Like, what are you talking about? Anyway, Haaland did dispatch his penalty.
Not been a great week for Carragher, is probably what I would say.
He needs to go on holiday, I think. So then anyway, 2-1, halftime, Man City in front. What do Real Madrid do to get back into it? Jude Bellingham misses a good chance. Puts it over the bar. And Xavi Alonso then starts to look towards his bench. Like, what does he do in terms of his game changers? Who could he look to? Because Mbappe was on the bench, there was a lot of discourse about, like, what, is he okay to come on? Because if he is, you need to bring him on. But ultimately, he didn't turn to him. And in the end, it was, as I said, Brahim Diaz, and then Endrick comes on as basically a last throw of the dice. Endrick actually almost scored, stuck a header just over the bar. But ultimately, I thought Man City played very well. I thought they controlled the game brilliantly. Guardiola, the former Barcelona man, has ultimately ramped up the pressure on Real Madrid, Xavi Alonso. This is a victory for Barcelona as much as it is for Manchester City. Although Barcelona won't want Xavi Alonso to lose his job because they'll be quite happy at the way things are going. Now, here's the thing with Xavi Alonso. Carlo Ancelotti was obviously criticised for not really having a game plan, not having tactics, not coaching.
Perhaps unfairly as well, I will add.
Well, maybe he was right not to, because Xavi Alonso is coaching. And it doesn't work. It's not working. And one of the issues you have at a club like Real Madrid is the only club in the world where the players are in charge, not the manager. The top tier of players run the club, and they'll ultimately decide how they're going to play and what they're going to do. And that is extremely difficult to come into as a coach. And you have to accept that there are limitations, I think, to your role. Now, maybe Alonso thought that because he's got some roots there because he'd done so well to get to this position in his managerial career so quick. Maybe he thought he could change some of that. Maybe he thought he could take on what Ancelotti had and actually coach them into a new system. It hasn't worked. And you do wonder now, in hindsight, is this just an argument between managing players and coaching players when you're at this level of a club like Real Madrid? Can you even coach them, or do you just have to manage them through moments and occasions?
On that note, I did read a piece in The Athletic earlier, and forgive me, I can't remember who it was by, but it was like just talking about the idea that whereas, you know, let's say any other club is, you know, up to 50-50, let's say tactical management and just management of players, just like literal human management, Real Madrid is like 80% towards the management in terms of human scale. The only thing I will say about this, and I can understand the frustration from Madridistas in terms of what they've been seeing in the last month. Like, I totally get it. Like, it hasn't been good enough. And that Celta Vigo performance was pretty poor. I think they've had worse games this season, if I'm being honest. I think that, you know, they were undone by a couple of moments of madness in that game in particular. But when you look at this, the question is, and the question I would pose is, last year, Carlo Ancelotti kind of got to the end of his tether, shall we say, in terms of, you watch that Barcelona side under Hansi Flick, and look, no one is saying that Barcelona team are perfect, right? We've been critical for most of the season of how easy they are to get at. We've talked about them in a variety of different ways. Even still, Barcelona kind of ran roughshod a bit over the back end of the league season and ended up going further in the Champions League than Real Madrid, who were relatively unceremoniously dumped out of the competition by Arsenal, who are a team very much set in a system, etc. And obviously, there has been success for Real Madrid under multiple managers. You look at Zidane and Ancelotti in terms of allowing the players a little bit more of that freedom outside of a system, shall we say, in order to express themselves and do what they need to do. And that's part of the culture and the DNA, and I totally get it. But are we coming to a point where that's not going to be enough to cut it anymore, where simply putting the best players on the park isn't going to be enough anymore? And is there a figure like an Ancelotti, like a Zidane, and look, Zidane might come in here for 7 months and he might take the Real Madrid job all the way to the end of the season, and then he's going to go and manage France because that's what he wants to do, right? So you get to this point and you're thinking, okay, who is the next person up that's going to be able to command that kind of respect within the dressing room so that there is still a level of, okay, we're being managed correctly here, but also give them that freedom to express themselves in the way that they've wanted to in the past. I don't know if that gets by anymore. And that's not to say that Alonso is the be all and end all or the answer. Like, and I'm not saying that, you know, necessarily he is the right man for the Real Madrid job. But I do wonder if we're looking at this from, you know, kind of a more holistic stepped back perspective, they do decide to make a change here, what the long-term future of this looks like. Because if you have a dressing room where the players control exactly how you play, and then that doesn't work, who ends up taking the blame for it? Well, it's Alonso, right? Like, or it's whoever's in charge of that situation. And, you know, at the end of last year, I think a lot of Real Madrid fans were like, okay, Carlo, thank you so much for your service, but it's also, you know, time for something new. It's time to get something else in and change it around a little bit. I'm just a little bit lost on what the next step is if it's not Alonso, because he felt like the quite cool combination of someone who had the, you know, the concept, who understood the club, who'd played there, who'd been successful there, and also someone who had the tactical mind to shift and kind of change a team to look like what he wanted. And I don't know where the next step you take is. And look, maybe there are managers out there. I don't know who they are, but there might be managers out there that do have that gravitas and also the ability to shape a team into something more cohesive. Right. But I wonder if we learned last year that the end of that kind of freewheeling era might be upon us. And again, you know, I might be wrong. Zidane might come in and win the Champions League and be like, that guy's an idiot. Like, what is he saying back in December that this might not work anymore? But I'm spitballing, if Ancelotti couldn't do it, who I think is a better manager than Zidane last season, is there going to be someone that actually can come in and make that work within the context of what these players want?
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm sure Zidane, if he did take over tomorrow, probably would have a better impact on these players. I don't think that Xavi Alonso will be sacked tomorrow. They've got a game against Alaves. I think it's away next. They've obviously just lost back-to-back home games in a matter of a few days. That doesn't happen very often. And when it does, it's deemed a crisis in Madrid. So there's no doubt that the spotlight is coming in sharper now. They've got a home game with Sevilla coming up, and we'll see where Alonso is at by the time we get to that one just before Christmas. I do think he'll still be in the job at that point, but yeah, any more of this and he might well be on his way because the natives just won't have it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that Xabi Alonso is going to be a success wherever he goes next if he does end up
moving on. I think it's harsh, by the way, for what it's worth. Like,
yeah, so do I.
It's so soon. It's so soon. And when you're trying to make such a radical change, it's impossible. It's almost impossible. And you're just assuming that because the players are so good, you will be able to ride it out while you implement those changes. Just to ditch him already after like 5 months, it's just like, blimey. I mean, what chance did he have?
It's also worth bearing in mind that Xabi Alonso's first sort of 7-8 months at Leverkusen weren't great, right? Like, and then look what he did with that team. That doesn't mean that you give him, you know, all of the leeway in the world. He should have learned from some of those elements by the time he's got to this job. But also, yeah, you know, look what he created when he was given the kind of backing and yeah, the time.
It's like Guardiola when he came to English football. You know, people were like, well, you can't just change our football, mate. You know, I can remember clearly people saying it, you know, of course he's struggling. You can't just come and introduce this form of football. It's like he literally transformed the way we played football in the Premier League, yeah, for a number of years as a result. But of course, that led to success. He's still there today. And this will be deemed a very successful result by him. He managed the game extremely well. He took a gamble himself because halfway through the second half, he made a triple change that if it had backfired...
This is wild, by the way.
Yeah, if it had backfired, this would not have read well. He took off Haaland, Foden and Shirky all at the same time on 70 minutes to bring on Marmoush, Reinders and Savinho. And that was the moment when there was a bit of a gear shift from Real Madrid and the momentum changed and they definitely had opportunities. They were able to ride it out and in fact, Savinho probably could have scored. But he was able to get through it. And in hindsight, it looks like he managed it very well.
Yeah, 100%. City travelling to Palace on Sunday off the back now of 4 wins in a row after that little wobble at the end of November with the losses to Newcastle and Bayer Leverkusen. Speaking of Bayer Leverkusen and going to Xabi Alonso's old side, let's go to their game with Newcastle United. 2-2 draw between these two. And this was a weird game, Dean, in many ways. Newcastle went for pretty much the strongest lineup they could, even with the derby against Sunderland at the weekend, which I thought was interesting. But despite dominating the ball for much of it, the first half, I thought they really struggled to contain the Leverkusen threat and created little of their own. They were undone early doors by a corner, which ended up going in off Bruno Guimaraes' own goal. And to be honest, I thought the Newcastle were perhaps a little bit lucky not see Malik Chow sent off in the first half, just minutes after that goal. Last man challenge, originally given as a penalty, and then decided by VAR to be outside the box. Now, Livramento might have been getting there, but it was close. A little bit of luck for the travelling Geordies. And Grimaldo surprisingly didn't score the free kick. And that kind of sparked this spell of dominance from the hosts. I thought Grimaldo and Tillman in particular getting way too much time in the Newcastle danger areas. And considering they were numerically outnumbered and considering this was Newcastle's strongest midfield, I thought Alex Garcia and Ibrahim Maza did brilliantly dominating the middle of the park for this period of the game. Newcastle did get some control back towards the end of the first half, but Leverkusen still looked really, really dangerous on the break and a really good stop from Ramsdale or Maza, which would have potentially killed the game at halftime. But things swung at the start of the second half. Newcastle got far more aggressive in their press from the front and it paid off almost immediately. Voltimada won a penalty. It's a bit soft, but it does come from really good pressing from Voltimada. He nicks the ball off Flecken and then gets his body in the way to draw the foul. I have no idea why Flecken goes to ground, but he does. And Voltimada then tumbles. Gordon tucks away the penalty. It's at 1-1 and it changes the game because suddenly it's all Newcastle United and they're driving forwards. They get their reward after a brilliant change from Eddie Howe. He brings on Lewis Miley and he scores his first Champions League goal mere moments after coming off the bench, getting on the end of an Anthony Gordon cross to head home. really lovely moment for him in front of the travelling fans, the Geordie boy, the local hero, getting his moment in that regard. So well, I was really pleased.
He's number 6-7.
Wow. Well, that one will go down in the cars well in the morning, at the very, I assume at the very least. Newcastle nearly made it 3, not only hitting the woodwork, but also a brilliant Flecken save to deny Malik Chow. No idea how he gets to it, claws it, makes up for his earlier error in giving away the penalty. And look, that almost shook Leverkusen back into life. I'm sure that their relentless ultras also played a huge part in raising those levels again. But Nathan Teller forces Ramsdale into a brilliant save. And there's this nuts period of Newcastle defending, which is like the last ditch off the line before finally they cave to a really well-worked goal. Lovely flowing move, ends with a Mazza pass into Grimaldo. He makes absolutely no mistake. Top scorer this season, considering he's a wing back. Like, to be outscoring Patrick Schick at the top of the pitch is really quite something. He goes steaming into the penalty area and fires it across goal. There were chances at both ends to win it, but in a game that really swung in terms of the momentum and the chances, a draw probably felt fair when the final whistle blew. And whilst I know that Newcastle fans are annoyed about the fact that they've thrown away another late lead in a game, there's a lot of talk about mentality. Yeah. I think from 1-0 down, taking a point at Leverkusen would have probably been something they would have looked at. And also, it felt like the fair result given the balance of the game to me.
Yeah, it's one of those you need to sleep on it before you lose your mind. You've got to travel back from Germany, get some sleep, and then go to a CAF, read the match report, look at a few photos of your trip and be like, yeah, it wasn't that bad, is it? It wasn't that bad. You're still in a decent position here. It kind of sums up Newcastle's season, though. Like, they're good.
They struggled on the road. You take a point.
Yeah, they're good, but they're not quite good enough yet to, like, see through moments. There was, like, that Tottenham game recently, even though that was at home. That one ended 2-2. They lost, obviously, to Marseille 2-1. A game that you wouldn't really have expected them.
No, they were good in that game as well, apart from a 10-minute spell where they completely lost their heads.
Kind of like this thing, I seem to keep saying it recently, but like inconsistencies even within one game. And they are one of the prime examples, I'd say, that I've seen across this season of that existing.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're 2 points off the automatic spots. If they'd won here, they would have gone up to 6th, I believe. Their next two games are at home against PSV and then away at PSG. So 4 points might be enough. Will they get 4 points on those two games? Who knows? Who knows? But look, I think they're in a decent position and they'll give themselves a crack at qualifying at the very least in those automatic spots. Yep. But yeah, I think it's a point that they probably would have just about taken before a ball was kicked. Right, I'm going to take a break there. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Arsenal's win at Club Brugge and also a good win for Juventus as well. Stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Champions League Takeaway here on Ranks FC, working through all of Wednesday's Champions League action. We've done the City win at Real Madrid. We've done Newcastle's draw with Bayer Leverkusen. Let's go to Arsenal, who had a little bit of an easier time of it away at Club Brugge, Dean.
Yeah, I mean, Champions League winners elect. We're looking at Arsenal here. Another win, 6 out of 6 now for Arsenal, and they can put their feet up, mate. They are good. They've got one of the automatic spots. With two games left to go, Arsenal are home and hosed, and it's probably just as well because they won't have any players left by the time they get to those last two. More problems in terms of team selection. Looks like Jurrien Timber is the next one that is going to be suffering a potential layoff, as we're told he's got a fitness issue. So he obviously joins a lengthy injury list that is ever growing by the day at the moment at Arsenal. But that's why this one would have come as a bit of a relief, I would imagine, because, yeah, even without the lengthy injury list, which does consist of Havertz, Mosquera, Rice, Gabriel, now Timber, Trossard, Saliba and Max Dalman, Arsenal came through a Champions League game and won 3-0. There's absolutely no problem. Like, that is the strength in depth. That's what you're doing when you're investing in your squad, in the summer and making sure that you can get through tests and also at the same time, obviously bounce back from disappointment, which is what they're doing after losing to Aston Villa at the weekend. So this was a very, very important game for Arsenal. It wasn't always easy. Noni Madueke did give them the lead with an extraordinary goal, to be honest. Like, it's
wonder goal.
It's brilliant from Madueke. Now, obviously, our head coach on Ranks FC, who's been on here many times, Harry Brooks, he's worked with Madueke before. Maybe he taught him this. But it was brilliant the way that Madueke kind of, the fullback comes into him. He's way out of, like, further than midway back in his, into the half. And Madueke kind of draws him in and then shifts the ball past him, throws him to the floor like he's a little boy, moves the ball beyond someone else and unleashes a shot from 30 yards. Honestly, like Madueke, I'm really impressed by him. I'm really impressed by him because he had to come through a pretty difficult moment when he joined Arsenal because of the way that his name was being thrown in the mud. And I don't believe that can't have affected him in some way. You know, you're making such a big transfer. It's pretty high profile. And it's quite exciting, but nerve-wracking. And you're just being slandered left, right and centre. And I think he's answering it very well. Club Brugge did have a spell from there where they kind of tested Arsenal and rattled them a little bit. But then came the very important second goal. And again, it comes from Madueke. Now, look, it will be written down as a header on the goal line. Sounds very easy. It is once you're
very
there.
Very high XG.
And it is. But what I loved about this is that Madueke actually gambles on the ball ending up there. He's the one who's taken a chance that that's where the space that you've got to be at in that moment. Zubimendi loops across towards the far post. And Gyökeres is kind of near post, like doesn't really feel like he's expecting much from it. But you're always taught as an attacking player, expect the worst from the other team's perspective to happen. Expect the best from your perspective, where you might get some joy. What's the best opportunity you're going to have from where he is right now? And Madueke just kind of gambles that he's going to come into the far post. So once it does, he's unmarked on the goal line with the easiest goal he'll ever score compared to the first one, particularly. So I was, in a way, as impressed with his one-yard header as I was with his 30-yard banger. Martinelli makes sure of things with a... another lovely goal, to be honest. He nutmegs the fella, then drifts inside and bangs one into the far corner. If you were a travelling Arsenal fan who went out there for this, you've had a lovely day. But there was just no risk left at the end for Arsenal. They were able to take off Gyökeres, take off Nkapie. Gabby Jesus made his return. He came on for the last half
really
an hour.
Really nice. I'll tell you what, the only thing that would have made that better was if that strike that had come off the bar had gone in. It would have been such a perfect return for Gabby Jesus, but it's great to see him back on the pitch again.
Absolutely. And, you know, you could tell that was a big moment for those fans that were there, but also I'm sure for his teammates too, to see him, you know, when you're a player in these situations and you're in and around the training camp and you're in the fitness rooms and you're seeing him go through all of his difficult moments and his rehab. And then he finally gets out of the turf to run or whatever. And you finally see him on the pitch. It's needed. And Arsenal might really need him soon. You know, Gyökeres, I think it's great that he was able to start this game. Shows that he's a step closer to getting back to his full capabilities. But now actually having Jesus available and probably not too far behind will be Kai Havertz if everything goes well from here. And so Arsenal will start to have those forward options again. They even managed to bring on another 16-year-old right at the end, Marley Salmon.
Marley Salmon, there you go.
So, there's not really too much analysis needed, mate, apart from the fact that Arsenal's strength in depth has shone through. They've come through a game in which they were forced to play Norgaard at centre back.
How did he do, by the way? I mean, obviously, this is quite a fun front three from Club Brugge. Like a huge fan of Solis, who is a wonderful footballer. Carlos Forbes, we've seen give defenders nightmares in recent weeks. And Trezoldi, I think, knits it all together really nicely. And all of them with Hans Vaneken pulling the strings behind. That's not an easy attack to come into. And I've seen Norgaard play in a variety of different roles, you know, both at Brentford and when he's been chucked in here at Arsenal. But I don't think I've ever seen him play centre-back.
No, but he's one of those players where you know that technically he's so prepared for any situation like this. And I wasn't actually that. Once I saw it, I was like, okay, it kind of makes sense because he's just one of those players. Like you trust Marino to go and play as a striker. I think you can put Norgaard in that same like basket of versatility that you can play him at centre back. And be okay with
very
it.
Very mature head on his shoulders is what I would say.
I think I would say he was fine. I mean, I don't think he was outstanding, but I think he was totally fine. I don't think there was anything particular to worry about. I'd say more than anything, it just goes to show the confidence Arteta and his teammates must have in him to trust him to play there on a Champions League game. I know it's Club Brugge and they're not the best team, but it's still a test for you to go in at centre-back, a position you're not familiar with, at the highest level possible. And ultimately, he's stepped up, he's helped his team out, and he's done pretty well. So I'd say full plaudits to him for being able to do that job.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, not great from Club Brugge, but not terrible either. You know, this is a very, very good Arsenal side. And ultimately, we look at it and you go, this is a team who changed their manager earlier in this week, like who are coming into this on a kind of fresh moment. And you come up against Arsenal in your first game, who are, you know, rip-roaring through most of their competitions thus far this season. Not easy, but I thought that they proved some headaches at times, and they didn't get the space they were allowed to exploit against Barcelona, for example. But still, you know, I thought that they you know, got a fair amount of shots away. They, you know, created a fair few chances and ultimately, you know, forced David Raya into some really good saves at points, especially in the first half. So I think that they won't be too disappointed with that as a performance. I do want to come on to Juve, though, Dean, because I think that they're an interesting talking point. They won 2-0 mm-hmm. against Paphos, which, as a scoreline, isn't going to shock anyone, right? Like, no one's going to look at that and be like, oh, weird result there. Juve winning 2-0 at home against Paphos.
I've only seen the
Paphos
scoreline. I don't know anything that you're about to tell me. So all I've seen is exactly what you've just described.
Well, I'll tell you what happened was that Paphos were just much the better side in the first half of this game. And the fans in Turin, you know, understandably, were pretty annoyed about the fact that they were really poor. So they hit the
They're
post.
Annoyed a lot of the time.
No, I know. But like this, I think, was like the kind of, you know, the high watermark in the first half of this. Because Paphos hit the post. They saw Di Gregorio forced into a reflex save from his own player. And they spurned two massive chances to take the lead as well. And I wrote in my notes, I am begging Spalletti to come away from this weird three at the back with Cote Miners in the left centre back position. That was the note I wrote when I was marking down this game. And that said, Juve came out swinging in the second half and they should have taken the lead when a save fell back to Yildiz, but he sort of uncharacteristically spooned one over the bar. Paphos continued to counterpunch and Orsic was keeping Juventus honest with a couple of long-range shots, but it felt like the chances were more at a premium. And then Spalletti went to a 4-3-3 around the 60-minute mark and they started to take the game by the scruff of the neck. And it did invite the counter, but as they did this, they get the breakthrough immediately. McKennie, who's gone to right back, drifts into the box from that position as Chico Conceição holds his position wide and he screams one into the back of the net. Really nice stuff from him. So Chico was out wide, wriggling about. He lays it back for Moretti and Weston McKennie's drifted inside and made this excellent run. Moretti's found him. Really good finish. And suddenly, Juve look like they can go through the gears and they did, right? They score a second goal very, very quickly after this. Brilliant work from Chico Conceição in the middle, slips a challenge and then just plays in Kenan Yildiz. First time, he slides it across for Jonathan David to slot home. It is incredible how much more aggressive they looked in this formation compared to the passivity of that first half. It was night and day in terms of what we've seen from Juventus. And we've seen so much of Spalletti's best football come in this formation, right? And it's baffled me how in these first few weeks he has just, you know, maintained and continued with this five at the back, with Cote Miners in there, which it didn't suit whatsoever. and kind of trying to ask them to switch between formations. Suddenly, Koopmeiners is into the midfield. He's popping up as a 10. He's linking things up together. You're seeing Kenan Yildiz drifting off the wing. You're seeing Chico Conceição holding the width. McKennie coming into the game from right back. And look, that might not be the move they go forward with. I'm not saying that McKennie's going to play it right back for the rest of the season. But suddenly, just in this formation and on the front foot, Juve looked like a different team. And it was just bizarre to me how night and day it was and how Spalletti has taken this long to realise that actually putting a few more offensive players on the pitch might lead you to be less impotent in front of goal. So a really good win for Juve, one that they very much needed. And whilst, again, it's not going to grab the headlines, I think, around the world with a 2-0 win over a Cypriot side, I thought that the actual storyline of this game was around the changes that Juve made and the fact that suddenly they looked the whole host better and suddenly they looked like a team that could really, really hurt you in that second half. Fingers crossed this is the start of something for Juve and for Spalletti that they can move into a formation that's starting to get the best out of those attacking players because they've been far, far too reduced for far too long.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some social media clips recently of fans kind of involved in verbal spats with the manager, and he's trying to like ask for patience and tell people to calm down. After this game, I just saw some quotes pop up on my screen as you were talking. Spalletti says, "Victory always solves a lot of things, but we need to do more. I'm not happy, and the lads aren't either." Do they say lads in Italy? Do they refer to them as lads?
Translation, I reckon. It's like they say ragazzi, right? So like the children, one of those things. Like it's just kind of used as a generalism.
Really jumped out on me that quote on an Italian page. I'm not happy and the lads aren't either. At times we did the bare minimum and there were some embarrassing moments. Tactics, I'm slowly integrating the 4-2-3-1. That's basically, in a nutshell, what he's saying on the back of it.
Well, that's good. That's good. Hopefully there's something that they work with going forward because Juve looks so, so much better once they sorted that out. Right, we'll take a little break there. When we come back on the other side, there's a lot of bits and bobs to wrap up across some very, very interesting games. So make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC.
Welcome back to Ranks FC. And before Jack goes, I need to hold my hands up because I made some disparaging remarks against Ajax yesterday in which I said they would not beat Karabag.
To be fair.
I kind of made fun of them. They were bottom of the league. They weren't looking very good. They went to Karabag. They won 4-2. So well done, Ajax. Just as I pass over the baton to Jack to talk us through everything else that I didn't see this week.
Well, I tell you what, I was going to start with the early games. I was going to start with Villarreal Copenhagen, okay. But we'll start with Karabag Ajax off the back of that statement, because I too
big 'em up.
Thought that they were going to lose this game. And when they went 1-0 down very, very early on, I was like, oh God, Ajax are in real trouble. So just a little bit of context about what's going on. Ajax haven't appointed a new manager after sacking Johnny Heitinger a couple of weeks ago. Fred Grimm, by name, by nature, has been the interim for that time. And basically what they've said is, we need a new technical director before we appoint a manager. So they're effectively going to the winter break with Fred Grimm at the helm. And it's not been great for him, but results have started to pick up in the last couple of games. And this win at Karabag, which has been a very difficult place to go. Karabag hadn't lost a game so far over the course of their Champions League tenure at home up to this point, including that 2-2 draw with Chelsea that we talked about extensively. But Ajax went there and won, claimed their first points of this season's Champions League. 3 late goals. But I don't think that necessarily told the full story of the game. So Karabag went in front sort of 9-10 minutes in. Camilla Duran, what a finish this is, by the way. If you haven't seen this, chases down a long pass and the goalkeeper, Yaros, is coming out to him and he just lifts it over him. Like one of those kind of one-touch side-foot volleys over his head as the keeper comes rushing out and like, tucks it away and wheels away in celebration. Really nice goal. And to be honest, Karabag probably could and should have been already 1-0 up by the time that this goal goes in. And you're thinking, wow, okay, what's this going to be? But Ajax kind of grew into it. They equalized just before the break. Kasper Dolberg only his second goal since returning to Ajax, cutting inside, rifles one into the bottom corner, a really good goal. But the halftime whistle comes at the wrong moment for Ajax. And when they come out on the other side of it, they concede again. They have another slow start to a half. And Carabag take the lead. Matheus Silva, it's a little bit unlucky this, right? It takes a deflection, it wrong foots Yaros. But at that moment, you're like, wow, okay. So Ajax had just clawed their way back into it. They just started to get a bit of rhythm. And as soon as the halftime whistles are kind of open and closed, they go behind again. And you know what? You can criticize the amount of talent within this Ajax team. And for weeks, I've been criticizing the spirit, the heart as well. I don't think they lacked any of that today. Really good goal to draw them level. Oscar Gluck picking the ball up and drilling one into the bottom corner. And then Anton Gai with the goal that sends Ajax ahead comes screaming down the right-hand side. The ball laid off to him. It's more really good work from Gluck in the build-up. It goes, ends up with Gai, and he sort of fires one. Like, you know where the ball sort of arcs across goal into the far corner, into the top corner as well, as the defenders on rushing onto it. Really, really good finish. And Gluck made sure of the win, you know, Carabag pushing up to try and find an equalizer. Gluck hits them on the counter and rolls one in the final minute. And you know what? Shouts out to Fred Grimm. Substitutions made all of the difference for Ajax. And look, Gluck will take the headlines, and rightly so, because he was brilliant. And he was very much the number 10 in that number 10 shirt, you know, that they thought they'd signed in the summer from Salzburg. He was the one brought in as the kind of centerpiece of perhaps this new era. And he has struggled a little bit, as the rest of the team have, but I thought he was absolutely sensational here. But Mika Gotz and David Klaassen both came on, and they were both imperative to the turnaround as well. So I thought Ajax would lose here, and they haven't. They've come out the right side of a really good 4-2 win, and I think it's probably too little too late for their Champions League hopes. Like, I don't think we're going to find Ajax in the knockout stages, but it's a really important win in the context of their season, especially with change still to come, I think, in terms of what we're seeing from a managerial perspective.
Yeah. And one of the games that we'll be talking about is their next league game, Jack. On Patreon, we will be looking at that game as one of our predictions. And maybe this changes the way we view it. Who knows? Who knows?
It's the Clásico this weekend against Feyenoord. So Dean and I will be talking through some of the weekend fixtures. And I'll also be looking through all of the Europa League action on UA Ultras on Friday. So if you fancy some thoughts on the Europa and Conference League and our look aheads to the weekend, please do come and join us on Patreon. The link is in the description. Right, let's go to the other early game, which was Villarreal 2, Copenhagen 3. And Dean, Villarreal's bizarre, dreadful European campaign continued on its course. They are out pretty much of the Champions League now. Just an awful trajectory all season. They lose 3-2 at home to Copenhagen at El Madrigal. And it was bizarre. Like, Copenhagen take a second-minute lead. There is no one marking El Yunusi as he drifts into the box to volley home in the second minute. And you can see the crowd are like, what is going on here? It's a great run, right? And it's a really nice finish, but no one is picking him up. And Villarreal are sort of shell-shocked by this. Copenhagen have a couple of other chances, but they drag themselves back into it. They equalize 2 minutes after halftime. It's a bit of a scrappy goal. And it's Santi Comesaña, who should have scored in the first half, actually, where he missed an absolute sitter. But he makes up for that, sort of bundling the ball into the back net, back of the net, the back post. And yet, you know, in that brief moment of joy, what happens? Well, Copenhagen score 1 minute after Villarreal have equalised Achuri's first time finish from a really nice cross, actually, from Zague. And then Villarreal find a way back into it again. Oluwaseyi, who joined in the summer from Minnesota United, really nice for him to score his first Champions League goal, Canadian international. But it's a clever little finish, right? It's a snapshot in the area. He takes it before any of the defenders or the keeper is set, and it ends up making 2-1. And then the game goes nuts, right? Like, it opens up at both ends. And finally, in the last minute, Copenhagen silenced the home crowd one last time. Andreas Cornelius, who only scores goals for Copenhagen, right, has never scored them anywhere else he's really gone in his entire career. And he's a little bit lucky. El Yunusi tries a shot from range. It bounces into his path, and he pounces and sort of lifts it over the keeper for the winner. And yeah, Villarreal, third in La Liga. You know, they're 5 points behind Barcelona with a game in hand. And eliminated from the Champions League after six games. Like, none of it makes any sense. And I was listening to Marcelino's interview afterwards, because I'm always intrigued. I think he's a wonderful coach. And he said one of the funniest lines I've ever heard. He said, "We were hoping that the sixth time would be the charm, but it wasn't to be." And what do you mean you're hoping the sixth time would be the charm?
Sixth time's the charm.
Like, that's one, not the phrase. And two, like, what do you mean? He also said this, and I thought it was really honest. He went, "I don't know what's wrong with us, to be honest, but we're not able to show in the Champions League what we're showing in La Liga. In this competition, we've conceded the most goals. In La Liga, we've conceded the fewest. I have no idea why it's any different for these players." So he's clearly as baffled as we are. Look, the goal for Oliver Seyi is a nice moment. And Villarreal are able now to just focus on the league campaign where they're going so well in La Liga. But I can't work it out. I don't know if anyone can work it out. But what the difference is between Villarreal playing when the Champions League anthem plays as opposed to when the La Liga anthem plays might just be one for the fairies. I think it might just be one we'll never know.
Maybe. But yeah, that is absolutely bizarre, but kind of fits with the way that this season's going, doesn't it? Because nothing really makes sense this season. Maybe we're going to get a really random winner of the Champions League, like Arsenal.
I tell you who it won't be. Villarreal. Right, let's move on to Borussia Dortmund 2, Bodo Glimt 2. Oh, look, we've talked about three yellow teams in a row. A great game in Dortmund, another all-yellow derby. It was weird seeing Glimt in any other colour but yellow, but I thought they looked quite smart in white, as opposed to Villarreal, who looked very weird when they rocked up the other week in purple. And I thought Bodo Glimt played really, really well here. That said, they have a mistake in them, which is where the opener comes from. Alassami just gifting the ball to Fabio Silva, who laid in Julian Brandt to open the scoring. It was a much-changed Dortmund lineup. You know, I talked about the Newcastle lineup earlier ahead of the derby. Dortmund have their own derby against Köln at the weekend. The front three here, Brandt, Silva, Fabio Silva, and Maxi Bayer, who's barely got a kick in the last few games. So I thought that was interesting. And Dortmund obviously take the lead here, but Glimt were always in the game. And they looked dominant in spells in the first half. And they got a well-deserved equaliser, I thought, after a clever corner routine. It was nice that the goal came from Alassami after he made the mistake that led to the opener. It's a short corner, worked out to Patrick Berg. And his Dortmund leave only one man out wide and they just are able to open up the angle. It's a beautiful cross from Patrick Berg. What a footballer, by the way. You're going to see a lot more of him at the World Cup. He's part of the Norwegian midfield there with Sander Berger and Martin Ødegaard. Just a really genuinely cultured footballer with the ability to make things happen out of nothing. I really, really enjoy watching him play. But he swings this beautiful cross in and all Alassami needs to do is get something on it. And it flicks past Kerbel in the Dortmund goal to go in at 1-1. And look, the second half played out much as the first one had. Dortmund probing, Glimt looking to make the most of their opportunities. Quite an aggressive approach from them, I thought. Dortmund's second was made down the right, which I thought they'd worked really well at the start of the second half. Jan Kalto on that side, making things happen at the start of the second period. He plays in a lovely cross and it was Bayer that dived in to meet it. Good save from Heiken in the Bodo Glimt net, but he could only push it into the path of Brandt, who tamped it home for his second. His 500th game in professional football today. So for two goals for Julian Brandt was quite a nice moment, I thought, for him. And look, Heiken, who couldn't keep that one out, then did keep his team in the game in the minutes that followed. Two good stops, one from a drive from Bayer from distance and the other from an Anselmino header that looked destined for the net. Like one of those ones where you proper claw it out after a header from a set piece. Really, really good save. And it paid off because Gjetil Knutsen, who is the Bodo Glimt manager, made a heap of substitutions and they really made an impact. They found the equaliser after a really good spell from them. Evian drove into the Borussia Dortmund box. His blocked effort fell to the truth. Jens Petter Halger, one of our all-time favourites here on ranks. He gave Kerbel the eyes and tucked it home. And to be honest, that kind of seemed to knock the stuffing out of Borussia Dortmund. I think they thought they'd done enough and it petered out towards the end without too much drama for the draw. But a really good game, actually, and both sides going at it a little bit like the Leverkusen-Newcastle game, maybe with slightly more Borussia Dortmund pressure than what Leverkusen had, but it never felt like Glimt were out of it. And they did really, really well to earn themselves a good point on the road. Talking of good results, how about this for Benfica beating Napoli 2-0, back-to-back wins for Jose Mourinho's Benfica. And suddenly, they look like they have a shot at making the knockout stages of the competition. Mm-hmm. look, they look done and dusted at the start of this campaign. Really bad start to the league stage. They're at 1 point joint bottom with Ajax, but two wins in two, up to 6 points. Big win at the Estadio de Luz. Mourinho getting one over Conte, I'm sure, won't harm his mood either. He made a couple of bold calls, Mourinho, in this one. He started the young Croat, Franjo Ivanovic, who they signed from Union Saint-Gilloise in the summer. I thought he looked really, really good through the middle. Smart movement, should have scored early when he was through one-on-one, but really nice stuff in terms of what he's bringing. Like, he's quick, he's got good feet, and he presses like an absolute demon as well. And Benfica started the game really well. They never really relinquished that control. They camped in the Napoli half to begin the game. They got an early opener, Richard Rios, with the opener, converting from Samuel Dahl's floated ball. It was kind of half cleared by the Napoli defence, and he was quite sharp to force it home in that moment. Richard Rios' team was one of those names that was thrown around a lot in the summer in terms of a transfer deal, right? Like, and, you know, there were a lot of teams interested in him. There was Premier League interest. He was someone that, you know, seemed to be destined for a move. And when he went to Benfica, I think people were a bit like, oh, that's an interesting move for him. And, you know, those early starts of the season, the changes of manager didn't really seem to suit him. But I think he started to make a real difference in the middle of the park. Napoli really struggled, I thought, with his fluidity. And look, it got to halftime at 1-0. Two changes from Conte at the break as he tried to get his side into the game. They were miles off it in the first half. But those changes didn't have the effect that he would have wanted because Benfica doubled their lead just 4 minutes into the second half. More good work from Rios. He finds Barreiro in the area and he slipped it past Vanya Milinkovic-Savic for 2-0. From there, Benfica tucked in and kind of welcomed Napoli onto them, but they were really compact. Very few clear-cut opportunities made by the visitors. Their biggest threat was David Neres, who was obviously back at Benfica after leaving them a couple of years ago. But even his kind of long-distance efforts, and he was the best of Napoli's bunch, I thought, today. But even still, there wasn't loads for Anatoly Trubin in the Benfica goal to do. So a really good performance and a really good win for Benfica. And suddenly things are starting to look up a little bit after they fought their way back in the Derby de Lisboa against Sporting at the weekend as well. Mm-hmm. Just a relatively good run of form across all competitions from a Benfica perspective.
Yeah, it's been a little while now since they've lost. So obviously, like, they were going through a pretty bad spell early on in the season when they just couldn't find any consistencies. But this is now starting to look a little bit more convincing when you look at what they've been able to pick up over the course of the last month. So yeah, big upturn there, and definitely domestically and now in Europe, looking good.
Yeah, keep an eye on Franjo Ivanovic. He moved for about 20 million euros in the summer. Still very, very young. He was raw at USG, but I liked him there. And I think that they're on to another one, another winner in the middle of the park. Obviously, he's going to have to rotate minutes with Vangelis Pavlidis, who replaced him here. But he looks a real player. So I'm sure there are going to be eyes on him. Right. The final game of tonight was a 0-0 draw. We didn't have any of them yesterday. We did have one tonight. Athletic Club 0, Paris Saint-Germain 0 at Saint Mamés. And to be honest, I don't have loads to say. It wasn't a game of great quality at Saint Mamés. Again, it just felt like one of those games where Athletic wouldn't score in a month of Sundays. It was a great game, though, from Unai Simon, who made a heap of brilliant saves, including two from Seni Mayulu. And Athletic's intensity, I did think, was really impressive for about 60 minutes of this game. They really kind of reduced PSG to snapshots in the first half. Once they tired a little bit, and with the quality that PSG were able to bring off the bench, they did have to rely on a couple of last ditch, you know, defenders and a couple of really, really good saves from Simon to keep it a 0-0. PSG will look at the return of Désiré Doué as a real plus. He looked a tad rusty when he came off the bench, but that's to be expected. And I'm sure he'll be back firing again soon. The closest anyone came, Bradley Barcola rattling the crossbar, cutting in off that left-hand side, lifting one over Simon, one of the very few that got past him, but cannon back off the bar. And just reward, I think, for Unai Simon after a very, very impressive display. There have been some question marks about him and being Spain's number one recently with the form of David Raya. This is one of the games you look at and you go, there's a reason he's got the shirt. And whilst David Raya is an absolutely unbelievable goalkeeper, you have to do something, or the incumbent has to kind of lose the shirt. And Unai Simon displaying just why he's got it as well. And look, quite mature from Athletic, I thought, considering it was against a PSG side. Yes, weakened at the moment, but still with an immense amount of talent in it. They had seven absences earlier in the week, Athletic, and it was nice to see Sanset back in the team. It was nice to see Nico Williams get the start, Iñaki on the bench. does maybe suggest that there's a turning point coming for Athletic soon, but they need to start putting the ball in the back of the net. They are still in contention for the playoffs, Athletic, although I think they're going to have to find something out of nowhere in the kind of January bit. But equally, there's a little bit of time for them to maybe find a bit more rhythm before they come back for those last two games. So fingers crossed from their perspective, but they'll be pleased with that point, I think.
Yeah, tough, but winnable games left for them. Atalanta away and Sporting at home. Definitely not easy, but ultimately, if that's what your Champions League campaign hinges on, then there are definitely possibilities there if they attack it in the right way. So we've got Villarreal and Kairat Almaty both rooted to the bottom of the Champions League group. They both only got 1 point now that Ajax up to three alongside Slavia Prague and Bodo Glimt. So congrats, obviously, to them, my new favourite team. Arsenal top on 18 points, Bayern second on 15 points, PSG, Man City and Atalanta currently on 13 points. Maybe that will help them out, knowing that Atalanta are already halfway there. Inter Milan, Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid currently make up the automatic spots.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Liverpool in ninth, level on points with Atleti and Real. Dortmund and Spurs behind them on 11. And then Newcastle, Chelsea, Sporting, Barcelona, all on 10. There's a lot to play for still,
Dave.
I think it's going to be a very, very exciting two match weeks when we come back in January for those games. But that means that it's the final, the end of the final Champions League takeaway of 2025. So what's that for me to do? Is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
No, mate, I think we have to say thank you to you, because the amount of Champions League football you manage to watch on a game night is pretty extraordinary. Like, you see pundits on TV struggle to assess what they're watching beyond like the main game that they're watching. And they've got every screen there. They've got notes being handed to them. And I, you know, it's a tough thing to do, but you have 20 minutes to quickly turn around thoughts on about 10 games. That might even not be enough. How many games is it? I lose track.
It's 9 games a night.
9 games a night. So that's close. And it's great, mate. It's really impressive stuff. So on behalf of me and the Rank Squad, thanks to you for watching so much Champions League football. I struggle to watch 2 games simultaneously. So for you to do all 9 is very impressive stuff, mate. Well done.
Thank you. It means that there are mistakes that creep in. But alas, we do our best to keep you across all of it. So yeah, thank you very much to all of you for listening and for listening to Champions League Takeaway across the entirety of 2025. It means the world to both Dean and I. There will be another episode on the feed this week. Doogie and Sam are going to be talking about the teams outside the traditional top six with hopes of Champions League in the Premier League. So make sure you're locked in on Friday for that. Dean and I have got a couple more episodes before we take a little break for Christmas. We're going to be talking about gifts for managers that they'd like under the tree on Christmas Eve. We've got a wrap up of 2025 coming on New Year's Eve as well. And then you're going to have Dean for a couple of weeks with some special guests while I go off on my honeymoon. So plenty for us to get stuck into and plenty for Dean to get stuck into over the transfer window that will no doubt occupy all of his time over the end of December and the start of January. But from us for now, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.